The California Report and the Evening News were brought to you tonight by Yokio Biofuels. Yokio Biofuels in Hopland, Ukiah, Laytonville, 472-0900. Well, this is KZYX 90.7 FM Philo, KZYZ 91.5 FM Willits in Ukiah, and K201HR FM 88.1 Fort Bragg. Also KZYX.org on the World Wide Web. Mendocino County Public Broadcasting, listener-supported community radio. It's just about 7 o'clock, and I want to welcome you. It's time for Education Now.
Are on the road must have a code that you can live by, and so become yourself, because the past is just a goodbye. Teach your children well, their father's hell did slowly go by, and feed them on your dreams, the one they picked, the one you know by.
Well, welcome to Education Now. Education Now tonight is a special edition of a pre-recorded interview with Dr. Dawson Church, author of The Genie in Your Genes. His new book pioneers the field of epigenetics, the control of genes from outside the cell, and explains the remarkable self-healing mechanisms now emerging from this science. I had a wonderful time with my interview with Dr. Church or Dawson yesterday morning, and I'm so eager to share it with you. So without any further ado, let's get started. Here we go. Good morning, Dawson, and welcome to the KZYX and Z Airwaves and Education Now.
Good to be here. Thank you.
Thank you so much for doing this, and I want you to know that I have just loved reading your book, The Genie in Your Genes. Can you tell us why you decided to write this book?
Yes, Athena, several reasons. One was that I found that there were bits of this awareness scattered in different disciplines. Some very advanced psychotherapists were aware and actually had speculated on the mapping of the genes that are being affected by psychotherapy. For example, when somebody is in a therapy session and has a high stress level, and then their stress level diminishes, the chances are quite good that the genes that code for those, that stress biochemistry, are being affected by the therapy. And so some therapists, there's a very dense book called The Psychobiology of Gene Expression, which you probably don't want to read as light reading, only if you're really into this material. But that was the therapy part of it. And then there was also the gene biology part of it and the evolutionary biology part of it. But none of these fields was really coming together. So I wanted to write a book which explained in quite simple terms, simple English, short sentences, easy concepts, just exactly how our genes are affected by awareness, by thought, by feeling, by emotion, by energy medicine, things like this. And also how quick the process is, how that our genes, the certain classes of genes, turn on and off very, very fast, within, you know, 1 or 2 seconds in some cases, and really bring this idea to people forcefully that biologists, of course, know, which is that our genome is not something predeterministic and fixed that determines our characteristics, but instead something that is fluid and is more like, our genes are like the notes on a piano, but which ones you press is very much up to you and your awareness. And so that link between gene expression and awareness was what I really wanted to bring out and illustrate in terms and ideas and concepts that people could understand without having to be an advanced scientist.
Well, you did a wonderful job. I mean, you've made the connections. That's the thing, I think, to see it holistically. You've made the connections so that a person can see it holistically. And that's what's so beautiful about it. I wondered if you'd talk a bit about, I know when I talk to people about this kind of medicine, that they feel like I'm telling them that the victim is responsible for their own health. And that's not what I'm saying. Could you clarify that?
Yes, I think that's the dark side of the idea that our consciousness affects our physiology. There's one subhead in my book that says psychology is physiology, and there's a strong link between our thoughts and feelings and the biological results in our bodies. But far from being an indictment of us for, you know, sometimes get a cold or flu, I had a backache earlier this year, and, you know, we do, as human beings, our immune systems are challenged by the shifting spectrum of viruses and bacteria in the environment. So they're challenged by toxins in the environment. They're very, very well equipped to deal with these things, of course, but nonetheless, there's a constant array of things which are pushing our immune systems to function and respond. And, you know, because we have some kind of condition doesn't mean we failed in some way. That's sort of the way in which this could be interpreted. And in fact, the very opposite is true. I encourage people, wherever they are in their state of health, they may be very, very healthy. You might be dealing with a terminal disease. But wherever you are, wherever you are along that spectrum, you have the ability to influence the course of that condition by the quality of your awareness. And the book goes into several specific techniques, I think maybe 11 or 12 of them, precise ones that do influence this group of genes that has so much to do with our health and well-being.
Right.
Rather than this responsibility meaning that you're responsible for how well or sick you are, it instead means that however well or sick you are, you have this wonderful opportunity to nudge this genetic symphony that's playing in your body daily in certain directions. And by taking charge of that, you in fact have a good deal of control and influence over your wellness and your happiness.
Over the symphony your strings play.
Yes.
I noticed in the chapter called The Malleable Genome, a quote, "The choices we make with our consciousness are being genetically encoded in our brain structure daily."
Yes, and in fact, this is one of the really exciting new aspects of neuroscience, and that is what's called brain plasticity. And the old idea, if you looked at a medical textbook or a biology textbook, circa say 1970 or even 1980. The image is of a brain that is static, that develops in the womb, during childhood, and then somewhere in the teenage years or early 20s is pretty much stable. It has all its synaptic connections formed. There are trillions of synaptic connections in the brain. They're all set up. They're determined by your childhood experiences, and that's the brain you have most of your life. That picture of a static brain, in fact, that picture of a static cell could not be further from the truth. For example, the axon sheets around the neurons in part of our brain, they are being assembled and disassembled. The molecules are being built and then taken apart by our bodies every 10 minutes or so. Even the girders, the microtubules that hold our neurons, that give our neurons structure, these are being assembled and disassembled every 10 minutes or so in our brains. So the picture that is now emerging in neuroscience and brain plasticity is much more of a brain on the boil, a brain that's changing constantly, forming new connections. a Nobel Prize-winning doctor, Eric Kandel, did work that showed that when you have a new thought or a new feeling, a novel experience, you can double the number of synaptic connections in that neural pathway within a few hours. Double them.
Yes.
And then if you don't use them, then they decay within, you know, two weeks, 6 weeks, thereabouts. But our brains are very rapidly changing as we recall old memories and form new experiences. And even the recall of old memories turns out to be partially data retrieval and partially creation. When we recall a seemingly old memory, we actually mix it with the new material in the moment.
Yes.
And we can reformulate it in that way. So we think we're thinking about the past, but in fact we're building the present into every single apparent memory of a past event that we recall.
Yes. You say our emotional and mental environment, which we create as individuals, is one of the primary influences turning genes on and off in our cells. And that doesn't matter if you're thinking about the past, the present, or the future.
No. In fact, your body has no way of knowing whether, if you have a vivid image or feeling that you create in your mind and your emotional realm, your body has no way of telling it's not a real experience. So, for example, I was on a radio show yesterday, and the show host had a dog jump at her and bite her and do quite, actually she needed quite a bit of surgery as a result. It was a very unfortunate thing, and the memory of that dog's mouth as it jumped at her was so vivid in her mind. And so she had the originating experience, the old experience of the dog barking and jumping at her and biting her. But then every time she recalls that experience with vivid intensity, emotional content, emotional charge, her body is producing all the same stress hormones as though the dog really was there. And that's why, you know, human beings have all kinds of diseases we don't see in lower animals, because we call them lower animals, but it's a bit of an irony, because with our brains, with our emotional bodies, we can conjure up these images and thoughts and feelings that our body then thinks are real, and it then produces all the stress biochemistry as though it was really happening to us. So we have, again, this is the way in which we have huge leverage over our well-being, because if we can release those stresses, then suddenly our body isn't having to get hit with this onslaught of stress biochemistry that results from us having those feelings and thoughts.
Yes, well, you mentioned stress, and this would be a good time, I think, for you to make that distinction between stress that's harmful and stress that's positive, which you do in the book.
Yeah, the originator of the term stress, he was a German doctor, and he began to observe in the 1920s that every disease has certain characteristics, and he called that stress. He also, though, divided it into two kinds of stress, and one is called distress, and we all know what distress means.
Right.
Distress. But unfortunately, the good side of stress is a word that's been forgotten, which is eustress, eustress. And so his name is Hans Selye, and then Selye divided stress into these two kinds of stress. And there's a positive stress that makes you get up in the morning and sing and chirp and be nice to people and run around and do things and be creative and be positive. And of course, there's also distress. And this is also reflected in our bodies, because our bodies need a certain level of production of these stress chemicals, like cortisol, for example. We need, cortisol is usually thought of as being a stress chemical that's bad for our bodies, and it is if we have lots of it over long periods of time. But we need a certain level of cortisol just to function during the day, and then we need a high level of cortisol produced very, very, very quickly if we're, say, attacked by a barking dog. So this biochemistry of stress has a enormously helpful role to play in our lives by getting us out of danger. The problem is, again, when there's no danger and we're thinking thoughts and having feelings that are producing distress And our body then keeps on with that flood of cortisol and adrenaline and all these other biochemicals that wind up having, again, our body is not designed to handle high levels of them over long periods of time. So that's where stress really bites and hurts us.
Right. Now, something that I wanted to be sure we talked about was active imagination, which Jung, I think, first coined the phrase, and we used in our school a lot, which is, you know, actively imagining a situation that you're in and actively imagining interceding and your performance. And the results were astounding to my students. And it's a technique that I've used in my life. And I noticed there's a great deal of reference to that in the book in different ways of actively imagining through prayer or meditation. Would you say that those are in the same category, active imagination?
Yes.
And visualizing?
Yeah, they are all in the same category. And what I call them collectively is epigenetic interventions. And the term epigenetic means things that affect the genome and affect gene expression from outside the cell or even outside the body. And our body is adept at transmitting messages from the external environment into internal biochemical signals. And the science of these signals and the body's response to them is called epigenetics. So it's effects on the genes from outside the cell. And so when we think or feel or imagine something vividly, we then are producing an epigenetic effect. And prayer can have that kind of an effect. Visualization can have that kind of an effect. Meditation can have that kind of an effect. Energy psychology, things like EFT or emotional freedom techniques. I'm doing some studies right now of EFT and its effects. And it appears to be, what it looks to me like it's doing is looks like it is deactivating the production of those stress hormones. So all of these things, visualization, meditation, prayer, healing touch, energy psychology, energy medicine, as a group, charity, altruism also has this kind of an effect,
right,
appear to be acting epigenetically in shutting down the production of the genes that code for stress hormones.
Right. I notice that what you say, you know, it's personalized, or you don't say it in those words, but you know that if it's a by rote, you know, like da 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 type of prayer or meditation, if it's not really, you know, something that's coming from you, you know, from your center that you're putting out there. And I like to stress the individualizing your practice of movement and centering and visualizing or meditating. And if you're going to really get results, it has to come from your center, not something,
yes,
some mantra that you learned.
It has to come from the heart, has to be deeply personal, has to engage you biochemically for it to work.
Right.
Yes.
And a lot of times the reason that these are difficult to discuss with other people is because they're ineffable. In other words, it's an experience. You can't give it to someone else. Once they have the experience, then of course they understand. But you can, you know, you put it together so beautifully in your book, but really once you have the experience, you can't give it to another person. Not your individual experience, not your individual healing or consciousness elevation.
No. And one study that showed this scientifically was, I had to laugh last year. There were huge headlines in the New York Times and the Washington Post and on news broadcasts, and there was a big study done at Harvard, and the headlines were things like, new study finds conclusive evidence that prayer does not work in healing. And it was a big study, and it had patients being prayed for healing after a heart operation, being admitted to a cardiac care unit for a heart operation, and it had people being prayed for by various kinds of religious groups. And you know, I was so amazed because there have been over 1,200 studies of prayer, and most of them show a significant effect from prayer. So I read this about this massive study that supposedly debunked the power of prayer. I was quite surprised. And then I read a bit about the details of the study. It turned out that everyone was instructed to say the same 11-word prayer at the same time, starting the day of or the day after surgery. And there was no variation allowed in the content of the prayer. Now, the other study, which I contrast, that was a study done for AIDS patients that measured their outcomes, how well they did. And that in this other study, the Zen people prayed their Zen prayers, and the Qigong people prayed their prayers for the transmission of Qi. And the Native American, the Lakota shaman who was part of this prayer study, used his shamanic Lakota prayers. And the Catholic woman put an image of the Virgin Mary on the altar and prayed to that. You know, they all pray their own
individual way.
Yes, and that study showed a marked improvement in the patients who were prayed for. So, I think we can say with reasonable certainty that that praying in a way that passionately engages your sense of the real, of the possible, of what's vibrant and vital for you, that kind of prayer works, whereas prayer that's just sterile and rote does not work.
Right. I understand completely what you mean. And have you ever heard of a woman named Ida Kolf? She did Santray therapy. She's dead now, but she's died. But she had incredible results using Santray therapy with children who had all kinds of disease. And they would start out making, you know, in the Santray with little objects and things, and it would be quite chaotic. But then when the cure was effected, the patterns that the children would make in the Santray were very mandala-like.
Interesting.
And the only disease she did not affect a cure with was leukemia, which was just amazing. But of course, she would talk about earth, balancing your earth, air, fire, and water,
right,
and that it's intuitive to the child that their own, if once their, you know, their own psyches will try to get in balance, and when that balance is affected,
yes,
a cure is affected.
Yes, a lot of this is intuitive to children. I think it was Jung who once said that if a psychologist at the age of 35 knows as much psychology as he knew intuitively at the age of 4, he'll be a very good therapist.
Yes, that's a beautiful point. It really is, and I think also honoring the process. I know that the arts. Dance, music, painting, drawing, creative writing, poetry, that's a lot the way psyche speaks. And to me, this healing is an interaction with psyche, because once you're in connection with psyche in a positive way and listening to your own center, then the world, everything is possible. Miracles happen.
Yes, and in fact, that whole idea that you're in phase or in tune. I mean, we know intuitively if we're in phase or in tune any given day. You can sort of rate yourself and how your rhythms are flowing, if they're really jangled and off, whether they're really really consistent. And it turns out this is actually very much at the heart of scientific study of physiology, because when we, like those children whose initial sand clay images when they were dealing with disease was chaotic, but later became mandala-like when they were on their way to a cure, just the same way, our biorhythms tend to be chaotic and out of phase when we're sick, and in phase when we're well.
Yes.
And the big set of discoveries about this have been done by this famous institute called the HeartMath Center, or the HeartMath Institute, and they show not only are our heart rhythms what they call coherent, If I had a visual display now, actually, I think I have a picture of this one page of the book. I think it's chapter 7 or 8.
Uh-huh.
But I actually have an image there showing what an EEG heart rate readout looks like of somebody who is in a state of anger. And it looks like a sort of jagged peak.
Yes, it does.
Downs, highs and lows.
I have it right here in front of me.
The same person in a state of appreciation, it looks like a set of absolutely uniform hills and valleys. And the exciting thing is that not only does our heart smooth out when we're in this heart-centered state, it also does several other things. One is it entrains the hearts of the people around us, but it also entrains the brains of the people around us and our own brains. So both our heart and our brain come into phase. Our parasympathetic and sympathetic nervous systems come into phase, and even other functions like peristalsis, digestion, and so on come into the same rhythm. And so the whole body literally is flowing rhythmically in the same way. So it's not surprising that that children, when they're doing sand play and they're sick, have this disordered kind of art. But when they come into a healed state, have a much more ordered kind of art, because that's, in fact, exactly what's happening with their bodies.
Yes, yes. Well, we're taking a break right here. This is KZYX 90.7 FM in Philo, and KZYZ 91.5 FM in Willetson, Ukiah, and K201 HR FM 80.1 in Fort Bragg, and KZYX.org on the World Wide Web. You're listening to a special edition of Education Now with Dr. Dawson Church, an epigenetic research. So we'll go on now, and here we go. Well, welcome back, Dawson. Could you please talk to us some more about gene expression?
Certainly. One of the big surprises here has been the speed of gene expression. And certainly there are genes that express once and for all things like height, eye color, hair color, and so on, and, you know, coding for 5 fingers rather than 6 and so on. But that's actually a very small proportion of genes. And many of them expressed in conjunction with signals from the environment. And there's this group of genes that I go into in the book in detail. And these are called the early genes, and especially the immediate early genes. And these genes express within 1 or 2 or 3 seconds of a signal. So, for example, to go back to the dog I mentioned earlier, example of the person who'd been bitten by a dog. When you see a dog running at you, those genes that code for your stress biochemistry immediately code for things like adrenaline. And so you have a surge of adrenaline right away. It doesn't take you 10 minutes for those genes to express. If it did, you'd be in bad shape. Instead, they express right away. So the speed of gene expression is really well worth mentioning. And it comes as a shock to people to realize that there are these genes which are popping on, popping off very, very fast. And in fact, with each thought they think, with each feeling they have, with every strong emotion they have, especially, these genes will be engaged. So we are all, every moment. I mean, right now, as I stand here, right now, as you sit there, right now, you are influencing the expression of that group of early genes.
Yes, yes. And you know, this is so exciting to me, because many people are still in that belief structure where the genes don't change.
Right.
So this is once you understand that it's not, the genes aren't static, that you can affect your genes, that you're not born with a certain set of genes and there's just nothing you can do about it, then all of this makes so much sense, and it's wonderful.
Yes.
That you can have, as a person, control over these things. In my mind, it's...
Yeah, the genes have sort of been given this magical sort of status in our society, where you read articles and hear stories about how This gene determines that characteristic, a gene for dyslexia, a gene for alcoholism, a gene for creativity, and a gene for this, gene for that.
Mm-hmm.
And this is really a skewed kind of way of reporting it. But unfortunately, I've seen New York Times headlines this year, 2007, that will tag a particular characteristic, which in effect is determined by many genes and the state of many genes, to just one gene.
Right.
For example, in heart disease, I think if I mentioned this figure in the book somewhere. In heart disease, something like 600 genes are expressed differently from people that don't have heart disease. In many diseases, there are dozens or even hundreds of genes that express differently. There are very, very few things, very few characteristics that are determined or turned on by a single gene.
Yes, I know with heart disease, as you were mentioning, there's heart disease in my family, and both of my brothers have had open heart surgery, three of them, three open heart surgeries, each of them, and I have not. And I like to believe that it's because of my practice, because I've always felt and that I could control, at least partially, with participation of my whole body, my skin, all the organs, my senses, seeing, hearing, smelling, if all those channels were open, that I could communicate with my body, and if I loved myself and I wanted to be alive, that would have a terrific influence upon my genes. I just believed that. And
well, you're totally right.
And I also think that a lot of it had to do with the fact that I was wanted as a child, where my brothers were not, that I was breastfed, that my brothers were not. So that probably gave me a leg up. But still, I have seen this, and yet I can't really. It's difficult because these experiences are ineffable to give them to other people. That's what I love about your book, Dawson. It's a fantastic book. And I can't recommend it enough to you. And it was told about your book by my doctor of Oriental medicine, Karina Maccabee, who said, "Athena, you have to read this book. You have to have this gentleman on Education Now."
Well, thank you. Yeah, the response to the book has been overwhelming. I mean, The Genie in Your Genes came out in May. It's gone through three printings already. And just the number of people, like your doctor, are saying you have to read this book. People are buying the book to give to their doctor. They're buying multiple copies to give to therapists, to healthcare providers of various kinds. It's just, I mean, the degree of enthusiasm for the book. And I was on a lot of radio shows for my last book, but I get on shows now, and there are hosts who are just huge fans of this book. It's just remarkable that somehow this book has galvanized, really caught the imagination of thousands of people.
Right, and I'm sure that the universe will give back to you for it, because I'm sure you've done it for yourself, but you've done it for all of us as well.
Oh, absolutely, and in fact, there's nothing original in this book at all. It's simply compiling the research and ideas of other people and putting them all together, but in a way that tells the whole story of how this intimate connection between our awareness, our thoughts, our consciousness, and our genes, and all of our systems is occurring every moment.
I'm trying to find. Here we go. I love this quote by Bernie Siegel. "If I told patients to raise their blood levels of immune globulin or killer T cells, no one would know how. But if I can teach them to love themselves and others fully, the same change happens automatically."
Yes.
"The truth is, love heals." Bernie Siegel, MD.
Yes.
That's so beautiful, because that's really where it's at, isn't it?
Well, the odd thing is that we think of things like love, consciousness, thought, prayer, intention, belief. We think of these as soft science. And if you ask a person who's being treated for a disease, what sort of treatment program are you on? They're probably going to tell you what drug they're taking, what surgery they've had. They probably won't say, "Well, my doctor prescribed that I go to synagogue four times a week and have long talks with my rabbi. Or the doctor probably hasn't written on his prescription pad, increase your meditation from a half hour to an hour every day. We don't think of these as treatment, yet in fact they turn out to be not only good treatment, but sometimes phenomenally effective treatment. There's one study of AIDS patients, which I go into in Chapter 2 of the book in quite some depth.
Yes.
And it was done at the University of Miami, the stress lab there. And they looked at a whole group of characteristics of AIDS patients, and then they measured the progress of the AIDS disease in their body. And then after the 4 years were done of the study period, they went and compared the initial intake forms showing these patients' beliefs and thoughts and all kinds of things about them to their results, their lab results for the level of AIDS virus in their blood. And they found that the single thing that most accurately predicted how fast and how far the AIDS virus went and how well their immune system was working out for 4 years was their beliefs.
Yes,
their beliefs were the biggest, strongest predictor of that.
Right.
Not how old they were, not whether they smoked or not, not whether they had engaged in risky sexual practices, none of the above. It was their beliefs were making all the difference.
Right. My students and I tracked this for quite some time, and they were just astounded. There were a group of AIDS or HIV-positive patients in the Bay Area that were being tracked, and because it had not become active. And what the commonality was among these AIDS patients was an excellent self-concept.
Yes.
And so I knew when I saw that in your book, it was like, right on, that is so true. And the other thing I wanted to be sure that we mentioned was that you're not saying that if you had a broken leg, you wouldn't go to the emergency room, right?
No, not at all. No, in fact, I love biomedical practices and technological medicine. It's full of just phenomenal assistance for us in various conditions. Where we go seriously wrong with it, though, is when we look for the magic bullet for many conditions which are best influenced by consciousness. And we've been used to thinking in terms of a drug for a condition for so long, and in fact there are some drugs which are very, very effective for certain conditions, but that's led us to look for a certain drug for everything, and the body doesn't work that way. The body works holistically and systemically. Our bodies work as a whole.
Yes.
And you know how sometimes you'll have I'm just trying to think of a good example of a systemic experience. When you have a cold, you might feel a bit depressed as well. When you're a bit depressed, you might be more susceptible to a cold. Our bodies work that way, where our hearts, our minds, our bodies, our spiritual life are all intimately linked. And if I don't meditate in the morning, I feel impaired the whole day. So we don't work as a series of... We have 1,000 proteins, which are the main workhorses of our bodies. They're the molecules that do things in our bodies. And these 100,000 proteins, we don't like have a drug that will affect each one. They are all acting simultaneously in concert in this wonderful dance of creation inside of us.
Right.
And it turns out that things like thought, belief, prayer, energy psychology can have effects that ripple throughout the body, through every system of our bodies.
Right.
We don't function in isolation inside our skin.
As I read your book, I kept thinking, everything old is new again. You know, the ancients would say, as above, so below.
Yes.
And of course, we're coming back to their... Of course, they were much more connected to nature.
Yes.
The more disconnected we have become from nature, the less we listen to that inner voice. And as a matter of fact, for a long time in Western world, if you spoke to an inner voice, you were thought to be schizophrenic. So, you know... you can understand why maybe people stopped. Another section is the amount of money that we spend in this country is staggering in the trillions, 27.7 trillion, and yet you say infant mortality rates are higher and life expectancy lower than every single one of the countries, other developed countries.
Developed countries, yes.
Right. And so... I love that, you know, that you're talking about how much we need, and no wonder that Andrew Weil begins an authoritative survey of the medical profession published in the Archives of Internal Medicine with these words, "The chassis is broken and the wheels are coming off." How can we slow the growing cost of our medical system? And of course, if people realize their power that they have,
yes,
then this would happen.
Yes. Well, if people realize the power they had of their own wellness, they would be shocked. I'm doing several studies right now, and one study is of people with joint rotation. In fact, by the way, I'm in Sonoma County, and we are currently this week and next week taking volunteers for a study of joint rotation. And this is people with frozen shoulder or some kind of upper body injury,
yes,
where they can't move, and so we will be actually doing this scientific experiment in the course of the next month.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the things that pushed me to doing this particular study was that I was at a conference earlier this year, and I was speaking, and I usually ask for a volunteer from the audience, or maybe two or three sometimes, that stand up there and tell their story, and then I do some energy work on them. And this woman stood up and said that she was standing up there because the left side of her face was frozen. And in fact, she looked as if she'd had a stroke. She was very immobile on the left side of her face. So knowing that our emotions are intimately linked to our physical functioning, I asked her what emotional experience there was that might be triggered by that. And she told me that her son had been kidnapped and held by his captors for several months. And after several months, he had been killed by the people who had abducted him.
Mm-hmm.
And
oh,
it was the anniversary of his death. And that's why she was up there. And so that was her issue, was that she had this frozen face. Now, when I did a little bit of digging, it looked like the place she was really frozen actually was around her heart, and especially her left shoulder. And her left, she only had a few degrees of movement in her left arm. She could hardly move her left arm forward or back. So I talked to her about her son's death, and it turned out that the phone call telling her about his death, I thought, was the biggest trigger. So we did energy psychology. We did this technique called emotional freedom techniques for EFT with her. I did just maybe 1 or 2 minutes of that, very little bit of time, and she regained almost complete mobility. She had to swing her arm round and round and round. After the lecture, she came up to me in the hallway, and she was swinging her arm in huge circles, and she was totally stunned. She said, "I cannot believe that this is happening. This big physical result from just this small bit of emotional relief." So we're doing a study next month, and we're actually asking for volunteers, and they can actually... I'll find the number before the end of the show that you can give to people to call if they want to register for the study.
Great.
But, if people have frozen shoulders or whatever, we'll do some work on releasing the emotional trauma, and then we'll measure actually what the degree of rotation is before and after we've done that. Because it often turns out that if you can release emotional trauma, the body just naturally heals itself.
Yeah, you see this a lot in psychotherapy. If people really respond to their old hurts, that there's an effect to the body as well.
Yes.
And I know that, you know, Tellington Touch, which is done with animals, I don't know if you know the horse whisperer, but I do know persons in this area who are incredible healers, T-touch healers, and I've seen results that they have with both animals and with children. But of course, you know, people will say, is it just the belief in that person? You know, you believe that person could help you, and so that they did. It's not really because that person is empathizing to such an extent that they take on your pain and then they release it. And I don't know what the processes are, but I do know that they work.
Yes. Yeah, and we don't know what the processes are, and that's one of the things you have to be patient with in medicine and research, because we'll see things happening, and we will have no idea why they work, and then may take much experimentation over decades. I mean, you know, a quinine for malaria, we had no idea how it worked for a century. Aspirin, we had no idea how it worked for a century. We used them.
That's right. That's right.
It did work. But energy psychology is one of those things where there have been these results like the one I described earlier coming out of treating people, and you know, scratch our heads and saying, can this really be having that? Can releasing the emotional distress really be having that huge effect on the body? But actually, there's a big study done by Kaiser Permanente called the ACE study, A-C-E, which is short for Adverse Childhood Experiences, A-C-E. And it took a look at the link between adverse childhood experiences and adult disease. And surprise, surprise, high levels of adverse childhood experiences would correlate strongly with, as adults, 50 years later, off these childhood experiences, 50 years later, correlates strongly with heart disease, hypertension, diabetes, cancer, depression, suicide, smoking, you name it.
Right.
It correlates with unresolved emotional trauma.
Right.
So what we're doing with this joint rotation study is seeing if we resolve the emotional trauma that underlies the physical condition, what then is the change in the physical condition? And it's not unreasonable to suppose that if you resolve that emotional trauma, you then will have an effect, you will have leverage over that disease.
Yes, I think that that's, that is exactly what's happening. And I think that really as a Western culture, especially as Americans, we have been out of touch with our emotions for a long time.
Yeah,
emotions are seen to be something feminine, something if you show your feelings, if you cry, you know. So, you know, this whole area of divorce from nature, our divorce from nature, our lack of a connection to it, or many people, and this lack of connection to our intuition and our feelings helps create a lot of disease, or when we do get the disease, because those functions aren't really working well, we can't release that energy and make ourselves whole.
Yeah.
It's wonderful that you're putting it into these terms in this book, where you know you can talk about it, and it doesn't sound like faith healing, because the science is here. That's what was so wonderful about Candace Pert's book, Molecules of Emotion, because you know the science was there. Which is very important. I don't want to disregard the Western view of science, and I think it's important. That's why I feel it's so important, the work that you are doing. But I think it's also important for people to realize that we didn't know why aspirin worked, just as you said, and yet we used it because we saw the effects.
Yes.
And so there isn't any reason not to use these things that are beneficial to our health, even if we don't have all the research yet. We're still moving towards it. Can we talk now about consciousness and the importance of consciousness? I know Montessori talked a lot about a cosmic consciousness, and I think that's the place we need to go if we're going to resolve the political problems with a whole mind.
Yes, and consciousness, the old view of consciousness, the sort of 60s and 70s view of evolutionary biologists, was that consciousness is an emergent property of increasingly complex biological systems. It's just kind of jargony when I say it that way. What the saying basically is that life began as single-celled organisms, became more and more complex, gradually emerged from the sea. Then there were various ages in which various life forms flourished, and eventually mammals came along. And through this, brains got larger and larger and larger in proportion to the size of the body. And eventually the brain became large and complex, and then out of a large and complex brain was born this new thing called consciousness. And that's sort of the old view, that that consciousness comes from the brain as a result of having a mind, and that when you die, the brain dies, consciousness is gone.
Right.
That view has really been challenged by a whole group of discoveries, not least the matter of the number of genes in the human body. We find that there are far fewer genes in the human body than the number required to construct a body or run a body. So if the genes don't have all of the information required, where is the rest of it? And consciousness is one plausible candidate for the answer. So consciousness, it now appears, actually underlies much biology, underlies many systems,
yes,
underlies many of these complex systems, that these complex systems actually are given rise to by consciousness and not the other way around.
Well, what I love is the Aborigines and their concept of how it all works, which is that we come from the dream time. And this is paradise, because we have our senses. We can feel, touch, smell, taste, experience. And that when we die, we go back to the dream time. And we can observe, but we don't have our senses. And I thought, well, that's so beautiful. I mean, that's the way that I visualized it as a child. And I know that my father believed that he would be able to observe when he died. His consciousness would be there, but he wouldn't be there in the physical sense.
Right.
And it's looking more and more like a lot of indigenous people. Somehow, could it be perhaps because they were more in touch? We're visualizing, we're expressing these ideas that you're working with now.
Yes, your father's idea that consciousness is eternal and then can dip into and form a human body and walk around for a while and then discard the body and then go on other adventures, I think is much, much more the sort of picture that's emerging from science now.
Yes.
And the old idea is that, you know, we have these brains, you know, we're the pinnacle of creation, we have these brains and we have these wonderful things called minds, and those things have consciousness.
Mind is everywhere. I mean,
if mind
is everywhere. That's
mind is everywhere and comes to roost in bodies.
Yes.
Occasionally, but is not constrained by the death or the birth of a body.
Yeah. Well, we've about come to the end of our time. This has been so fun for me, Dawson. I just can't thank you enough for taking the time to do this, and I want you to give out some contact information. Where can people go to get more information on your book or to connect with these wonderful ideas? Do you want to give that out?
The best way to get the book quickly, and there are a whole bunch of freebies as well, there are a whole bunch of free goodies on the site, it's Genie, G-E-N-I-E, GenieBestseller.com. And again, there are all kinds of free odds and ends you get from buying the book there.
So that's www.genie, G-E-N-I-E, bestseller, BESTSELLER.com.
Yes, and of course in all the bookstores, and there's also a link from Genie Bestseller to my nonprofit, which is soulmedicineinstitute.org. And people can link there straight from the Genie site. And there are also like lists of therapists there who practice these techniques. If you need any kind of physical or psychological help, there's help there. There's lists of research projects there. There are newspaper articles talking about miraculous cures of post-traumatic stress syndrome and huge increases in athletic ability. All kinds. I mean, there are just stories cropping up all over the media now of enormous breakthroughs that are used that happen when consciousness comes first and is used in this way.
Yes, it's so exciting, and I can't thank you enough, Dawson, for what you're doing for all of us and for the world. I mean, hopefully with consciousness we can make a change, a needed change, make a quantum leap. I love what you say about string theory. It's so holistic. And I just...
Yes, well, as individual human beings change and heal, then all the collective psychoses and neuroses that lead them to make war and conflict disappear.
That's right.
And we then don't have to act out those things on a global scale. So it does change the world as we change ourselves.
That's right, but it has to happen one person at a time.
Yes.
Right. Thank you so much, Dawson.
It's been a joy. Thank you.
Thanks so much. Bye now. Well, this is Athena Melville, your host for Education Now, and I hope you enjoyed as much as I did the interview with Dr. Dawson Church, author of The Genie in Your Genes. It's so very exciting, very, very exciting. And I want to thank David Moore for all of his help, and Karina Maccabee, who's a member of the board of the Hermeneutic Institute for Holistic Health and Education, for telling me about this book and telling me about Dawson. It was wonderful. I want to thank the listeners and the staff here at KZYX and Z. And this show and all shows on Education Now, you can listen to or download at pacificsites.com/Hermes. That's pacificsites.com/Hermes. I want you to stay tuned for Earth and Sky, and then after that, Reality Check with David and the gang, and then Dead Air at 10 o'clock. Tomorrow morning is Hot Flash at Friday, tomorrow morning at 9 with Karen Autobody. This is a time of bountiful harvest. Plowshares and the community food banks are in greater need than ever before. What's going on? Tune in to Hot Flash on Friday morning at 9 a.m. for details. Karen Autobonny's guest will be Mary Buckley, director of Plowshares, where there is sudden urgent need for fresh food. Then Open Lines Friday Forum, Friday at 1 p.m., listener call-ins with Doug McKenty. Then Conversations from the World Cafe at Friday at 7 p.m., David Dye explores the life and work of Warren Zevon, including an interview recorded in 2000. And then at 8 o'clock tomorrow night, Terminal Whimsy celebrates the first year on the air with Andrea, who will be playing some of her favorites for you. Well, I thank you, and I want you to stay tuned at the top of the hour for Earth and Sky, and we're going to go out with some music. This is some music I would play for my students after we talked about global warming. Here we go. This is Olita Adams and Brenda Russell from Karina Karina.
Sun follows rain, strength follows pain. Oh, oh, we will find a way. There is a plan, peace follows understanding. Oh, oh, we will find.
Sail above these waters.
Well, this is Athena Melville, your host for Education Now, saying good night, and thank you so much for listening. At the top of the hour will be Earth and Sky, followed by Reality Check with Dave and the Gang, and then Dead Air after that. So stay tuned. This is KZYX 90.7 FM Philo, KZYZ 91.5 FM Willits and Ukiah, and 88.1 FM Fort Bragg, Mendocino County, listener-supported community radio. Good night, everyone. Time for Earth and Sky.